James made it clear he did not re-sign with the Cavs because of the team they had. He did so because he felt a calling to come home and to change the viewpoint on his career. Privately, he believed Irving's potential was attractive, but Irving's re-signing to stay in Cleveland for 5 more years didn't affect his feelings on his choice. However, the reality was James joined a team where Irving was the established star, who had been at the centerpiece of everything. James knew Irving was a potential superstar who could help him win, and like he'd done in Miami with Wade, he was committed to finding a way to make things work. But it didn't fully work in Miami until Wade willingly took a step back to allow James to be the central figure. Wade was older than James and already a champion with a secure legacy, none of which the much younger Irving had. Irving hadn't made the choice to play with James as Wade did. When Irving signed his extension the previous July, it was after he'd been sold on a vastly different scenario. Though playing with James had undeniable advantages, it was something that was forced on Irving. That awkwardness was manifesting itself quickly. Leading up to the season, James and Wade had talked with each other about this dynamic. They were closer friends and had played together several times on Team USA before becoming Heat teammates. And yet there were still plenty of nights where they'd left the locker room upset with each other as they went through the process. Irving and James had no such background to lean on, and they came from different eras. James grew up idolizing Michael Jordan, who ruled his teams with an iron hand and led by example and brute force. Irving grew up idolizing Kobe Bryant, who led by sheer will and often viewed his teammates as inferior, so just took what he felt was needed. It was clear the two Cavs had a journey to go together, and the turbulence was arriving quickly. "You know, LeBron can do it again because he's a little younger, but I wouldn't want to do it all over again. That was a grind, man," Wade told Bleacher Report about James having to go through another assimilation process with a fellow star. "It was a great grind because we got success out of it, but I wouldn't want to do it all over again. More kudos to him for doing it all over again. You've got to go through the same process, you know?" As James left Salt Lake City, next stop Denver, he had some clarity. The fine line he was considering over the first week of the season got a little bolder in his mind. If Irving couldn't be counted on to share the ball, and if trying to force it with passivity didn't work, James would move into active mode. It had started with his scolding of Irving in Utah, and was soon to be followed up. Irving did show a different mindset in the game against the Nuggets. In fact, he broke his streak of 70 minutes without an assist just 90 seconds into the game when he set up Love for a basket. He only tried one shot in the first quarter and didn't score. But James also grabbed the wheel. That night, a 110-101 win, James essentially took over much of the point guard duties from Irving. He had 6 assists in the first quarter alone and 11 for the game. After the game, Blatt and James explained it was a strategy decision because of the style of defense the Nuggets used that night. It was one of the few things the coach and player agreed on over the following few weeks. After the win in Denver, the Cavs launched into a 4-game win streak. Irving kept passing the ball. He even had a 9-assist game, and it appeared the team was finding some rhythm. To get there, however, Blatt was riding his stars with heavy minutes. He slashed the playing time for Waiters and Mike Miller, and started giving more to rookie Joe Harris, the team's second-round draft pick from the previous summer. With Dellavedova out with the knee issue and Miller, Waiters, and even Marion struggling, the Cavs started to look like they had depth problems they hadn't expected. The winning streak ended with a sluggish home loss to the Nuggets, a team that had been 2-7. It kicked off a losing streak and a period of growing tension between James and Blatt as they traded a series of barbs. After the loss, Blatt said the team didn't come with the proper mindset and with the energy level that we had the other night and have had the last several games. James refuted Blatt's analysis, saying, "I didn't feel that. It's easy to say that after the fact." The next day, James raised the issue of his minutes. This was often an evolving topic for him. For years, he would express concern at minute totals, but he'd also sometimes not want to come out of games when he was on a hot streak. At that moment, though, he thought Blatt was playing all the stars too much. A few weeks into the season, James was 3rd in the league in minutes at more than 41 a game. Irving and Love ranked 4th and 5th in minutes played. Some of the veterans James had brought in, specifically Miller and James Jones, weren't playing much. I think we have to give our guys on the bench more of an opportunity. I looked at the stat sheet, and myself, Kyrie, and Kevin are three of the top five guys in the league in minutes per game, James said. That has to come down. I don't want to do that all year. You want to be smart about it. Blatt again was on a different page. Right now, LeBron has said and has told me that he's feeling good, and he's starting to feel his real game shape, he said. So this is not the time to think about resting him. He's feeling good. Let's not overlook the fact that he's been playing great basketball, and he looks good physically. He looks excellent. So for the foreseeable future, we're going to ride that. In a game that was deemed to be a possible finals preview, the San Antonio Spurs came to Cleveland and beat the Cavs by 2 points. Blatt had heard LeBron's comments and slashed his minutes to 34 after playing him more than 40 in 7 of the previous 9 games. But his rotations were all off as he sat James, Irving, and Love all at the same time, which didn't make much strategic sense, and it twice led to Spurs runs. He played the rookie Harris the final 18 minutes of the game without substituting him, perhaps forgetting about it. Harris was gassed at the end, and the Spurs' Manu Ginobili beat him to score the game-winning points. Late in the game, Blatt called several timeouts in succession. During one, James was talking with the players without Blatt in the huddle. At one point, Blatt had to force his way in. This visual soon became a talking point, especially for those who remembered Blatt throwing players off the bench when they attempted to talk over him in the Olympics. Eventually, the Cavs ran out of timeouts. Early in the season, Blatt relied on top assistant Ty Lue to help manage timeouts, which are handled differently than in Europe because some are compulsory at various stages of the game, tied to television commercials. There's an art to it, and some experience is needed, and Blatt was learning. Spurs coach Greg Popovich, one of the most experienced coaches in the world, perfectly managed his timeouts and had 3 available in the final minute. On the deciding play of the game, James had to try to push the ball up the floor after a rebound with 9 seconds left instead of perhaps using a timeout that could have been saved for such a situation. He turned the ball over and the Cavs lost. After the game, when questioned on his timeout usage and his substitution patterns, Blatt hinted he shouldn't be the one blamed for the loss. "I don't take all the credit for anything," he said. "I'd like to not take all the blame for everything, but that's part of my job, so I have to do that." James did take the blame for the turnover, but things were quickly getting to the point where James and Blatt appeared to be bickering via the media. They were having conversations before, after, and during practice, but it seemed both were satisfied in sending at least some messages indirectly. The chill started to become more clear. The veteran Popovich was watching, and, gracious in victory, he waved away the suggestion that the Cavs were having problems. "They're going to be one hell of a team. But it's a new system, new bodies, and it doesn't happen quickly," he said. "I'm glad we played them now. They'll be a whole lot tougher later in the year." Then he reflected on what it was like when he was a first-year coach, as Blatt was dealing with, and he put it very succinctly. "You either know what you're doing or you don't," Popovich said. "You either can develop or garner respect from the players or know how to deal with a group and be able to lead it or not. 2 days later, the Cavs were blown out by the Wizards in Washington. The body language of the team sagged, including James, who became visibly upset and didn't run back on defense once when Waiters took an ill-advised 3-pointer. Love scored just 8 points, his fewest in 2 years. The Blatt offense that had flourished and been praised in the preseason was unrecognizable. "We're a little bit in the dark," Blatt said, "and we've got to find our way out." As the Cavs rode the bus to Dulles International Airport for their charter flight home, James posted a message on his Twitter account that quoted Martin Luther King Jr. "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge." It didn't exactly diffuse the situation or help calm nerves that it was still so early in the season. A day later, the Toronto Raptors blasted the Cavs by 17 points back in Cleveland, dropping their record to 5-7. The team's reserves were outscored 91-25 over the 2 games. The front office had already started to realize the team wasn't as deep as projected. General manager David Griffin believed he might have to make a trade during the season to add to the bench. That timetable looked like it had to be moved up. As Waiters had another subpar game, he scored just 6 points, Griffin and his staff began to discuss how they might be able to trade him. James spent the last 6 minutes of the Raptor loss on the bench, staring out on the floor as Blatt stood silently. This wasn't going how any of them thought. "We're a very fragile team right now. Any little adversity hits us, we shell up," James said. "But I'm very optimistic. I'm very positive. More positive than I thought I'd be right now." James was positive because he sat there on the bench and gotten closer to making a decision. He was about to make a change. He was about to execute a bloodless coup. His star teammate, Irving, didn't know it. Neither did his coach. "Nah, I can do it on my own," James said later. "I'm past those days where I have to ask." Chapter 7. What Other Coach Do We Have? The sideways glances met each other around the huddle. David Blatt was sitting in the middle, sliding a pen over his greaseboard, instructing Sean Marion where to go on the important offensive set that was about to take place. Marion, however, was not in the game and had not been told to check in. Blatt had simply lost track. The players noticed things like this happening during the coach's first few months on the job. Sometimes he would have the same player in two different places when he drew up plays, or assign the same man two different assignments on defense. Other times, his hands were shaking as he drew the lines. Sometimes he let assistant coaches come to the center of the huddle to draw the plays. There would be times when LeBron James would dispute the strategy. Blatt didn't just have to make a choice on what to run, he had to sell it to James. And mental mistakes, especially as they piled up, did not help the pitch. During practice scrimmages when the coaches called fouls, a naturally controversial situation, players noticed Blatt sometimes clammed up when there were arguments. In Europe, when the coach made a ruling, whether it was a foul call in a scrimmage or who was taking the last shot in a playoff game, his authority was almost never questioned. Blatt, who was revered in Europe and adored and massively supported by Israeli fans, was used to authority. But this was not the case in the NBA, where power is fleeting for many coaches, especially those without accepted experience. James was ultra-competitive. At times, he'd have a meltdown over losing a scrimmage or drill. In frustration and losing, he was known to take the ball and heave it 80-plus feet to the other end of the building. When he didn't agree with a foul call, be it in the final minute of a playoff game or in a routine end-of-practice run, he would protest. When he would slow practice down ranting and raving about some call, Blatt would become a wallflower. Sometimes it took assistant Ty Lue to step up and tell James to shut up, it was a foul, and go run the next play. Within weeks, the players, notably the wing of veterans, started to whisper. They had begun to believe that Blatt, who arrived with a reputation as a short-fused taskmaster, was actually afraid of James. In retrospect, perhaps Blatt should have told James on that first day to hold his requested meeting later. It might have upset him, but it might have fostered respect. Many of the Cavs players liked Blatt personally. He was generally good-natured and many liked his personality. They just didn't really know what kind of coach he wanted to be. The veterans were aware he was in a challenging spot, but they weren't sure of the identity he wanted for the team. The older players preferred that he be more communicative. The younger players, like Irving and tough-nosed guard Matthew Dellavedova, seemed to bond with the coach more easily. Opinions on the early days between James and Blatt are varied. Different people on the team saw different angles. There were times when Blatt did show some of his trademark mettle, and times when James was supportive and fell in line. But there was no disputing Blatt was in a tough situation. Frequently, James didn't offer support within the team and in public. Within weeks, it seemed James wasn't completely invested in his coach's success. Combined with Blatt's sometimes shaky poise, it was not the best recipe for developing a bond between the coach and the best player. So as the Cavs sat with a 5-7 record as Thanksgiving approached, James felt he needed to make changes, and he didn't feel Blatt was vital enough to be wholly included in the process. "I have a low tolerance for things of this nature," James said as he evaluated the Cavs' record. "So it's something I'm working on as well, which I knew from the beginning that that was going to be my biggest test to see how much patience I've got." Starting with the game against the Orlando Magic, James effectively took control of the primary ball handling, pushing Irving to play mostly off the ball when they were on the court together. The concepts Blatt had installed in the early season were gone, and the offense came to life. The Cavs rolled off 8 straight wins, turning their prospects around thanks to James's playmaking. They beat the Magic by 32 points, and James racked up 29 points and 11 assists. They avenged their loss to the Wizards, pounding them by 26 points, as James registered 29 points and 8 assists. They beat the Indiana Pacers by 12, as Kevin Love had one of his finest games, scoring 28 points with 12 rebounds. Love had 27 points, Irving 28, and James 26 points and 10 more assists as the team beat Milwaukee. Irving had a huge game in Madison Square Garden as he put up 37 points to beat the Knicks, James repeatedly setting him up as the de facto point guard with 12 more assists. James had 13 assists and a revenge win against the Raptors. Then he scored 35 points the next week when they beat the Raptors again. The winning streak eased the tensions and enabled James to focus elsewhere. On one memorable night in Brooklyn during the streak, the team executed a protest and mingled with dignitaries. In warm-ups, Irving and James wore shirts that read, "I Can't Breathe," a reference to an African-American man named Eric Garner, who had been killed as police attempted to arrest him on Staten Island. The tragedy was captured on video, where Garner could be heard telling the police he couldn't breathe. It created a national reaction. James and Irving violated NBA protocol by wearing the shirts and showing support after other athletes had done the same. Once the game started, focus turned to the Royals, as Prince William of England and his wife Kate Middleton arrived while on a rare visit to the United States. They sat courtside next to Jay-Z and Beyoncé, making for an irresistible moment that had photographers craning and the crowd too transfixed to watch the game, which the Cavs won yet again as James led the team in assists. Afterward, James met with the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. The stuff that you read about, people like them are only in books growing up. And to hear they're coming to town to see me play and they want to see me do what I do best, it's a huge honor, James said. As the Cavs left New York, James posted to social media a picture he had taken with the Royals and said it would be going on his wall. In the photo, he'd posed with his arm around the Duchess, which was frowned on immediately by the British press because it defied protocol that no one is to touch the royal family. Such is the day in the life of LeBron James. The royal family mini-gaffe reinforced that nothing early in the season could be drama-free. Sure enough, the Cavs' winning streak came to an end in Oklahoma City when James had to pull himself from the lineup with a sore knee. Then, during the first half, Irving landed awkwardly on his left leg after defending a shot attempt by Russell Westbrook. He crumpled to the ground and yelled, "Call Steve," to his teammates, meaning athletic trainer Steve Spiro. Irving feared he'd done something to his left knee. He avoided serious injury, but the scare derailed the team. A week later, they didn't dodge the injury bullet. Anderson Varejao tore his Achilles tendon as he reached for a rebound in a home game against the Minnesota Timberwolves. He would be lost for the season and face a grueling recovery. It was a blow because the team was already thin at the position, and because for a player in his 30s, an Achilles tear is devastating. The team had just signed him to a 3-year, $30 million contract extension in October. The news of the MRI came down on Christmas Eve, as the Cavs were about to fly to Miami. Then there was the Waiters issue. After losing his starting job, Waiters had been pouty at times and insufferable at others. Always known as a shoot-first guard, he had grown frustrated by his lack of playing time and lack of shots. Sometimes he'd physically jump up and down when he was open, demanding the ball, then slump his shoulders like a child when he didn't get it. Waiters' South Philadelphia neighborhood was immersed in violence as he grew up, and it had a profound impact on him. When he was 8, he and his mother were caught in the crossfire of a shootout in a park, and he escaped bullets by falling to the ground. When he was 14, one of his cousins was shot and killed. When he was 15, a close friend and teammate was shot more than 10 times and died. Another of his cousins was murdered a few months earlier. In the spring of 2016, Waiters' brother died in a shooting in his old neighborhood. When Waiters committed to play at Syracuse before his sophomore year of high school and at age 19 became the number 4 pick in the draft, it was not only a remarkable success story, it was a remarkable survival story. His past shaped his game. He played with anger and like it could be all taken from him. There wasn't much finesse. There wasn't much nuance. He was often at his best trying for the impossible. He didn't always excel doing the mundane but needed tasks. James had hopes of molding him, but had quickly given up at Waiters' insistence on playing his preferred style. Knowing Waiters was hoping for a contract extension the following year, Griffin had met with him and talked about the role he could fill next to James that could make him valuable to the team. This also failed. Veterans like James Jones, Mike Miller, and Brendan Haywood tried to counsel Waiters. They told him he needed to play differently with James, to cut off the ball to get open or to run the floor with him and offer himself as an option. Waiters flat out told teammates that wasn't the way he played. Whether his points were valid was immaterial. At best, he was going to be the team's fourth offensive option. This was a fact, even if he didn't want to accept it. Blatt was playing him less than 10 minutes a game on some nights. The front office stepped up their efforts to trade him. Players started to whisper that his days were numbered, and the media's attention on his plunging playing time grew. The loss of Varejao was worrisome, because he was one of the team's true quality defenders. The defense, which Blatt had wanted to make a calling card, often lagged. This was a challenge, because Irving, Waiters, and Love were not good defenders, and the Cavs didn't have a classic shot blocker to guard the rim. In addition, the team's lack of depth on the wings continued to be an issue. Meanwhile, Kevin Love had started to show some signs of frustration. He went through a period where he only averaged 10 shots a game over a two-week period, 9 fewer than he'd averaged the previous season. He knew his touches would drop, but the process was starting to get to him. Sometimes he would show exasperation at not getting the ball. It was just as Chris Bosh had forewarned. All these developments made the team feel like it was on a losing streak, even though they came into Christmas having won 12 of 15 games. James admitted he had some butterflies returning to Miami. Wade, attempting to be magnanimous and to help his friend, gave several interviews before the game asking fans to be respectful to James. "I think he should be received very well at the start of the game," Wade told Bleacher Report. The fans booed James, but it was nothing like when he returned to Cleveland after signing with Miami in 2010. Midway through the first quarter, the Heat played a video tribute to James's four seasons, and the crowd gave him a standing ovation. James waved and appeared to get a little emotional. Had the Cavs tried to show a video tribute in 2010, there might have been a riot. As for the game, the Cavs played poorly and were beaten soundly by the Heat. James had 30 points and Wade had 31, a duel that delighted the audience. Luol Deng got some revenge on his old team, scoring 25 points. In the second half, Love tried to throw a long pass to James and, summing up the day, overshot him. James tried to chase the ball and ended up going into the stands. He leapt over the first row of seats and landed hard, and pain shot up his left knee, which had already been bothering him. He went to the locker room and was done for the night. Late in the game, Irving aggravated his left knee that he tweaked in Oklahoma City. All in all, it was a miserable Christmas for the Cavs. "We're not that good right now," James said, summarizing everything surrounding the team. The next night, the Cavs were in Orlando. James played, though maybe he shouldn't have. Irving did not, his knee aching. Upset about the team's play in Miami, upset about the defense, upset about Waiters, and cranky because of his knee, James was disconnected for much of the game. Some at courtside were taken aback how he ignored Blatt during the game, sitting off by himself during timeouts. Midway through the third quarter, James was guarding Magic forward Tobias Harris, a young player James had no history with. Harris whipped around and his elbows just missed James's face. James backed up and glared, and the two started yelling at each other, with Harris finishing by barking, "Stop flopping," to James. Though he's one of the most physically imposing players in the league, opponents had been annoyed with James's knack for exaggerating contact over the years, something that was commonplace for the whole team when he played in Miami. In an instant, James's demeanor turned. No longer floating and uninterested, he went on the attack. He scored 18 of his 29 points over the last quarter and a half and smothered Harris on defense, holding him to one basket. The Cavs ended up winning by 9. "The words that he said, that got me going," James said. "I was actually in chill mode tonight, but chill mode was deactivated after that." The incident was a great way to spice up the game, but it overshadowed two things. One was James essentially admitting he was taking a game off, chill mode, and the other was that Blatt benched Love in the fourth quarter because of defensive issues. At one point, Blatt asked Love if he wanted to go in, but he'd sat so long, he just waved him off. Griffin had been talking to teams about trading waiters for weeks and was getting traction with the Thunder, who were seeking a way to bolster scoring in their backcourt. Separately, he'd also been talking to the Knicks about trading for one of their available guards, free agent-to-be Iman Shumpert. When Varejao went down, the front office had to start looking for centers as well. For months, the team had been trying to get the Denver Nuggets to trade them Timofey Mozgov, a huge 7'2" center whom Blatt knew well from his time as the Russian national team coach. The Nuggets had resisted or asked a huge price. But Griffin had another problem. Ownership had gotten jittery about Blatt, and conversations about whether there needed to be a change had been taking place. Griffin was against it. He knew the team was a little banged up. He also knew he hadn't given Blatt the kind of depth he needed. The veterans he signed were struggling, and Blatt didn't have many live bodies to bring off the bench, especially when Dellavedova got hurt. 2 days after the game in Orlando, the Cavs were pounded at home, losing to the Pistons by 23. Irving missed another game. As a Detroit native and resident, Gilbert didn't take well to losses to the Pistons. The Cavs played lifelessly, and the rhetoric afterward was as bad as it had been all year. "We're not a very good team," James said, echoing what he said at Christmas. "We're still trying to find our way." Blatt admitted he wasn't doing the best job, but said he wasn't concerned about losing the team, which was now 18-12. The next day, ESPN reported that his job was in jeopardy. Blatt reacted negatively to the report, saying it was unfair. When James was asked about the news, he gave an evasive answer. "Yeah, he's our coach. I mean, what other coach do we have?" James said. When asked if he should give Blatt an endorsement, he made it clear it wasn't up to him. "Listen, man, I don't pay no bills around here." Irving, on the other hand, defended his coach. "I would do anything for Coach Blatt." With the pressure building, the team was dealt another setback. As the Cavs prepared to play in Atlanta, a sore back James had been dealing with worsened. His knee was also still bothering him. Shortly before the game, the Cavs scratched him from the lineup, and he spent much of the first half down in the Hawks locker room in their whirlpool trying to loosen up his back. It was his 30th birthday, and this wasn't how he wanted to spend it. He was feeling his age as he watched his team fall down by 10 on their way to another loss, his cursing echoing off the walls throughout the locker room area, catching Hawks employees off guard. The next day, New Year's Eve, James went to the Cleveland Clinic to get an MRI. It showed significant inflammation in his lower back. This at least explained why he hadn't looked like himself physically for the previous few weeks. Team doctors recommended he get a powerful anti-inflammatory shot to help the issue, a treatment that would sideline him for 2 weeks. He had never missed more than a week due to injury in his career. James had fought advice to rest for several weeks, but now couldn't do it any longer. He got the shot and skipped that night's game with the Milwaukee Bucks. So did Kevin Love, whose own back had seized up on him. The team was crushed by 16 points, their fourth loss in 5 games. It was the close of a trying week for Griffin, who was holding off a push to fire Blatt while pulling together a complex trade. He'd found a home for waiters in Oklahoma City, but was trying to get his hands on Shumpert as part of a 3-team deal. The Knicks wanted a first-round pick for Shumpert, but Griffin didn't want to give it. He needed his picks to get Mozgov. The Nuggets were demanding 2 first-round picks. The Knicks also wanted the Cavs to accept J.R. Smith in a trade, a volatile shooter who'd been a darling in New York when he won the 2013 Sixth Man of the Year award. He'd fallen out of favor with new president Phil Jackson after 2 suspensions over the previous year and for his love of the New York nightlife. Griffin wasn't in favor of trading for Smith. He was the type of player the Cavs needed, a wing with good size who could shoot. But he was so prone to bad decisions that much of the NBA considered him toxic. As he did the summer before when he was mulling the Love trade, Griffin asked the Knicks for permission to talk to Smith. They had a phone call. Smith had been offended when he heard how the Knicks were basically attempting to give him away and attach him to Shumpert like a bad debt. he told Griffin he'd walk to Cleveland. Griffin brought the topic to James. Smith and James were just a year apart and had gotten to know each other as teenagers. After James's first season in 2004, Smith came to the NBA right from high school, and the Cavs considered drafting him, but instead took a more seasoned player, Luke Jackson. Ever since, Smith had wanted to play with James, and several times he came to Akron in the summer to work out with him. With the team badly struggling and in need of a talent injection, James told Griffin he should make the deal for Smith. When Griffin expressed further concern, James said he'd take on the responsibility of keeping Smith in line. Griffin met with his front office and ownership, specifically co-owner Nate Forbes, who was always involved in such matters. They were still shaky on Smith, but James's reassurance and the call had turned them around a bit on the issue. Shumpert was in the last year of his deal, and Mozgov had a team option for the next year. Those investments were safer. Smith had a $6.4 million player option, which had the Knicks turned off. If Smith was a bad fit, the Cavs would be on the hook and wouldn't be able to get rid of him. Ultimately, with Forbes's and Gilbert's support, Griffin decided Smith would be on a short leash, and they would just release him and pay him off if the plan didn't work. Finally, with some clarity, Griffin and his front office started finalizing the details of the trades. They were trying to assemble a four-team deal with the Thunder, Knicks, and Nuggets that would send out Waiters and a first-round pick and land Shumpert, Smith, and Mozgov. The mechanics of such a move are complex, but Griffin still had another fire to put out regarding Blatt. With James out and the Cavs headed for a long West Coast trip, Griffin knew things were probably going to get worse before they got better. But he also believed Blatt deserved a chance to work with a more complete team. Over the previous summer, it was Griffin who was skeptical of Blatt, but Gilbert who wanted him. Now here was Griffin making the case for Blatt to get more time. With the trades about to come down, Griffin was able to calm the storm and get agreement to give Blatt a chance after the trades. So on a Sunday morning, January 4th, Griffin called an impromptu news conference before an afternoon game with the Dallas Mavericks. He blasted the concept that Blatt's job was in danger and made it clear he would not be fired. It was a classic vote of confidence, even though Griffin tried not to package it in that way. "Coach Blatt is our coach. He is going to remain our coach," Griffin said, and chided the media for stories attacking Blatt in the previous days. "Do not write that as a vote of confidence. He never needed one. It was never a question, so don't write it that way. That narrative is done. No change is being made, period." Without James, the Cavs responded by losing to the Mavericks by 19, with Irving pulling himself midway because of back spasms. Griffin, though, wasn't paying attention. He spent much of the game on the phone in his office next to the locker room trying to put together his deal. The final piece was when the Knicks dropped their demand for a first-round pick and had agreed to take a second-rounder because Smith was in the deal. As Griffin was finalizing trading him away, Waiters went 4 of 14 shooting in the loss to Dallas. He missed one three-pointer so badly that it hit the top of the backboard, prompting boos from the crowd. Griffin felt like he was on the verge of fixing the roster. He thought his strong comments to the media backing his coach would end that drama until James could get healthy and the new players would turn things around. On January 5th, 2015, Waiters was excited because he was making his first start in 2 months, and it was going to be in front of dozens of his friends and family members at Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia, not far from where he grew up. Irving and James didn't make the trip to Philly because of injuries, and Waiters was promoted to starter. He was announced and was removing his warm-ups when Rajah Bell, the Cavs' director of player administration, mysteriously arrived on the bench and told him he had to come with him to the locker room immediately. The Cavs had been plotting this trade in one form or another since the previous August. In addition to Waiters and the draft picks and bench players Alex Kirk and Lou Odmundson, the Cavs used something called a traded player exception to execute the deal. It functioned like a gift certificate created by previous trades. Team Director of Strategic Planning Brock Oller and Team Counsel Anthony Liotti hatched a multi-layer plan that involved five trades with four other teams. Every few days over the summer, the Cavs had made minor transactions that barely went noticed because they mostly involved swapping future second-round picks and end-of-roster players. But it ended up becoming crucial to the team in completing the deal. Another factor in the trades was owner Dan Gilbert agreeing to take on $9 million in additional salary as part of the swaps. The moves put the Cavs into the luxury tax, meaning it would cost Gilbert around $15 million in actual additional dollars. The previous summer, the team had gone nearly $23 million under the cap to sign James, and now were nearly $15 million over it. The league had never seen a swing of spending like that. It fulfilled the promise Gilbert had made to James that he'd spend to put a team around him. Griffin's relief was short-lived. As the team trumpeted the arrival of the new players, there was another dust-up. It became public James had gone to Miami to work on his back and knee rehab on his own. It made sense, James going to the warm weather to help his back. On the other hand, the optics were terrible. The Cavs were struggling and had just been beaten by the Heat, and James, who was only on a one-year contract, was back in Miami and spending time with old friends. The Cavs had cleared the trip, but hoped it would stay secret. That was by design, Blatt said, forced to explain the situation. He hasn't been around per orders of the doctor. After losing with a depleted roster in Philadelphia to a team that was 4-28, the Cavs lost again by 12 points at home to the Rockets. Irving came back and looked great, scoring 38 points. But Mozgov hadn't yet arrived. Shumpert was nursing a shoulder injury and wouldn't be back for 2 weeks. And, in his first game, Smith shot 0-5. The Cavs were about to leave on a 5-game trip to the West Coast. Even though James was feeling better and nearing a return, the Cavs had lost 6 of 7 games and were in free fall.
Chapter 8. Fit Out, Fit In. When LeBron James returned from his midseason Miami vacation, his back was feeling better, and his activity level was ramping up. He'd rejoined the team in San Francisco, the start of their longest road trip of the year, but wasn't ready to play yet. As the team prepared to depart for a morning workout ahead of that evening's game with the Golden State Warriors, the elevator doors opened, and a giant human being ducked his head out. David Griffin brought Timofey Mozgov over to James, and he made the introduction. James cursed at the size of the man. He'd played against Mozgov for years, but had forgotten just how big he was. As the team left, Mozgov went to Stanford Medical Center, where the team had arranged for him to have a physical to complete the trade. When Mozgov got onto the treadmill, he was too tall, and a ceiling panel had to be removed so he could stand and run. Alterations made, he passed, and the deal was finalized. The team opened the road trip with an 18-point loss to the Warriors, who were blitzing through the league with a 29-5 record. The concept that the two teams would be possible playoff combatants in the finals felt far-fetched at the time. Smith had a terrific game in his first start, scoring 27 points and showing some of the flashes that the Cavs were hoping might come from their gamble. Mozgov, who teammates quickly began calling by the nickname Timo, started at center 2 days later and immediately played well, scoring 14 points with 12 rebounds. But the Cavs were still deep in a funk, as they were miserable defensively in a 19-point loss in Sacramento. It dropped the team to 500 at 19-19, and happened against the Kings team that was in the midst of losing 11 of 13 games. With James and Irving in and out of the lineup, Love had put together several games with good stats. This was another one, 25 points and 10 rebounds. But he was being transported back to his Wolves days, when he put up big numbers on a bad team. At this point, despite James still being out, the questions were growing about what was going on. Defensively, the team remained lifeless, and Blatt remained unable to shake them from the slump. He was asked afterward how a team that still had two healthy maximum salary players, Irving and Love, was unable to play better. "Kevin's not a max player yet, is he?" Blatt said. These sorts of exchanges had become typical with Blatt, who often challenged reporters' questions. But this was not the best answer, because indeed Love was earning a max salary for that season. Whatever Blatt meant to say, it came off sounding like the coach disputing Love's salary and standing as one of the league's best players. Love had also been getting crushed defensively during the losing streak. Kings power forwards Rudy Gay and Carl Landry combined to score 34 points on 67% shooting that night. So Blatt had underlying reasons for being lukewarm on considering whether Love was playing like a star. But in the delicate world of dealing with NBA players, that was a needless slip-up. With Love headed for free agency, media and fans seized on such commentary, and it quickly became a topic on talk shows. It was a comment that the Cavs ended up having to address internally. After the game, the team flew to Phoenix. The next afternoon before practice at Grand Canyon University, Blatt met with Love and tried to smooth over his comment. Then he gave a half-retraction, explaining that his words had been taken out of context. "I was simply saying that with our team, he does not have a max contract, because we aren't allowed to talk to him about anything until after the season is over," Blatt said. "I just wasn't clear in what I meant, but I hope now he understands exactly what I meant. Kevin Love for me is a player of the highest order." Again, this was not accurate, because Love was indeed playing at that very moment on a max contract. The exasperation with Blatt not simply openly admitting he'd insulted the player, on purpose or not, only furthered some growing angst. "I wanted to get the context of it all," Love said. "He's right. We can't talk about anything about this summer or contracts or anything of that nature, so I just let it roll off." All of this was a distraction. While Blatt was trying to clean up the mess, the team had one of its best days in weeks. James returned to practice for the first time and took the floor with Smith and Mozgov. The rest and treatment clearly had made a difference as he looked explosive. For a team that had lost 8 of 9 games, it was uplifting. James announced he would return the next day against the Suns and then hurried out a back door to go to the airport, where he'd chartered a jet to fly to Dallas and watch the college football national championship game between Ohio State, his favorite team, and Oregon. He was a guest of Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones and sat in his suite. James's return was an unhappy one. That night, the Cavs lost again to the Suns to fall below 500 on the season, giving up 53% shooting. Midway through the second quarter, James was called for an offensive foul, and Blatt stormed onto the court to protest. James came over and pushed Blatt back towards the bench so he could argue with the referee. Under another circumstance, the act might have been ignored. But with James's public dismissiveness of his coach throughout the season, it came off looking to some like another belittling act. "Coach Blatt was getting a little fired up about it, and he was on his way to a technical foul. So I just got him up out of the way before he got a tee," James explained. "Just protecting my coach," explained Blatt. "I just thought my guy was taking a lot of hard hits, and I didn't like it, and I was expressing my opinion. And LeBron stepped in to, I guess, protect me in that situation, which is more than fine. But what I really wanted to do was protect him." It illustrated just how off course the season had gone. James and Blatt were both trying to protect each other, but because of all the team's unrest, it became another controversy. As the Cavs tried to make a comeback late in the game, Blatt once again chose to bench Love throughout the fourth quarter. It was a tactical move that helped, since Love's defense was again an issue. Suns power forward Markieff Morris scored 35 points in the game, and Love struggled against him. But because of the events of the previous 2 days, it again took on a political layer. All the things that Griffin had tried to defuse with his public vote of confidence for Blatt were coming up again. Moments after the game ended, Love and Griffin held an impromptu meeting. The two went into the practice court next to the Cavs locker room, Love still wearing his uniform. One of the Suns players, Miles Plumlee, came to the practice court to work on his shooting after not having played in the game. He ran into Love and Griffin in the middle of that discussion and immediately turned around and left, knowing he'd just accidentally walked in on something. When it came to talking about it, Love stuck to James's edict from the start of the season and kept it in-house. "If you told me I was going to sit out the fourth quarter, maybe I would have thought it would have been tough. But we had a great rhythm going tonight. I thought the group we had out there was doing a great job of getting us back into the game," he said. Amid that sideshow, James looked excellent. He had 33 points and 3 explosive dunks, saying, "I couldn't make those moves 2 weeks ago." Smith, in his first game playing with James, drilled 8 three-pointers. Had Love played a little better on defense, or Irving, who had 8 turnovers, played just average, the story might have been different. Instead, it was another stressful night. After the game, the Cavs made the short flight to Los Angeles. They scheduled a practice for the next afternoon. When the team boarded the bus at the Beverly Wilshire, the players were expecting to go to Westwood to practice at UCLA, as teams had done on off days in LA for decades. But they went towards West Hollywood instead and pulled up at a bowling alley. In an effort to blow off some steam, Blatt, as a surprise, had set up a team bowling trip instead of practice. It was well received by the players, who hit the lanes. Later, this day was referred to as a turning point. The laughter and bonding was a relief. But of course it was more complex than that. As guys in basketball shorts threw gutter balls, they discussed a rumor that was going around. The origin was unclear, but the players were hearing it from their agents. If the Cavs didn't turn things around in their two games in LA to end the road trip, Blatt was going to be fired. Whether or not it was accurate, the players were discussing it, and how they responded would be an indication of where they were with their coach. The team, however, was feeling positive. Getting James back was a major boost, and the new players were delivering. In addition, in practices on the road trip, Blatt had been installing a new defensive strategy. With Mozgov and his rim-protecting ability, the team was working on changing its scheme. Some of it was aimed at making things easier on Love, who had been getting roasted as the previous strategy required him to cover more ground than he was used to. When the team arrived at Staples Center, they were confident they'd end the losing streak. They did, beating the Lakers by 7 points. James looked healthy and active again, racking up 36 points. Irving bounced back as well, scoring 22 points. During the game, Cavs players openly discussed with some Laker players the prospect of their coach possibly being fired. Late in the game, there was a pivotal moment in a timeout huddle. After sitting much of the second half, Kobe Bryant had scored 7 quick points, and the Lakers had cut the lead from 9-4. Blatt wanted James to switch over and defend Bryant, who had been scoring on Sean Marion. James declined. Blatt was silent. Assistant Ty Lue stepped in and barked at James. "Bron, you take him. Shut that water off." James reversed course and agreed. The Cavs closed out the game without more damage from Bryant. Moments like this had been happening for weeks. Lue stepping in at practice to calm a situation. Lue stepping in during a film session when Blatt ignored a mistake James had made. Lue helping Blatt with substitution patterns and timeout management. It was a crucial win, and everyone had a piece, even Love, who was still dealing with a sore back. He suffered another bout of back spasms during pregame warmups, but played through it and scored 17 points. In the fourth quarter, he made a key defensive play, taking a painful charge when the Lakers' Jeremy Lin ran over him. He would end up sitting out the next night because of the back issue. But the Cavs won that game too, beating the Clippers 126-121 for their best victory in weeks. James had a third straight strong game with 32 points and 11 rebounds. Irving scored 37 points, nailing 5 three-pointers with 5 assists. At the start of the season, Irving and James clearly lacked chemistry playing together. And then James purposely reduced Irving's ball handling. It was a frustrating time for Irving, who was being shoehorned a bit into a role he wasn't familiar with. Over the following months, Mike Miller had spent time with the young guard, and they had many conversations on how to play alongside James and where to pick his spots. Miller wasn't having a good season. The Cavs were thinking he was going to provide a significant contribution as a shooter off the bench, after he'd hit 46% of his three-pointers the season before and didn't miss a game. But he didn't arrive in great condition. Neither did their other veteran pickup, Marion, and he was having the worst season of his career. But Miller's easygoing personality helped him connect with teammates throughout his career, and he'd become someone for Irving to lean on. That was where he was making a contribution. Miller and Irving became regular dinner companions on the road. Miller knew the challenges of learning to play with James, of finding ways to succeed with star teammates. As Irving spent more time with Miller and more court time with James, he clearly started making progress. Now that James was getting over his back issues and Irving's knee was feeling better, they were getting traction playing together. The 1-2 punch they delivered against the Clippers was the best example yet of their budding partnership starting to form. In the final minute, there was once again some intrigue in the huddle. With the Cavs ahead by 4, Blatt drew up a play for Irving, where James would be a decoy. James wanted to change the play, saying he wanted to take the ball out and inbound it to Irving. Blatt agreed. When the play went in motion, James looked to Irving and froze the Clipper defense, which allowed Tristan Thompson to make a backdoor cut. James fired a perfect pass to Thompson, who scored and was fouled to finish off his own 24-point night. It was a perfectly executed play that sealed the win. James immediately pointed to Blatt, letting everyone know he was to get the credit. This was quite a moment, because they both came up with a play, and it was James who'd made the great read. Blatt had been the subject of so much undercutting by James, both within the team and in the media, that it was a surprising turn, all part of the seesaw experience of coaching James. "The play was good. The pass was much better," Blatt said. "LeBron made the play." The two wins made the long flight home enjoyable. Blatt had been pulled back from the edge, the pressure around him easing. James's public praise helping. The changes Griffin had made were starting to bear fruit. After 2 days off, the Cavs opened a homestand by crushing the rival Bulls. In his first game in Cleveland as a Cav, Mozgov had 15 points and 15 rebounds and was an effective defensive presence. Smith nailed 6 three-pointers as the crowd started to like his ability to get hot. The 3-game win streak had Blatt pulling back his shoulders and rediscovering some confidence. After going into a bit of a shell during the losing streak and the faux pas with Love, he began to exude confidence again. His turn in attitude was personified by his return to admonishing the media for negative stories during the team's struggles. "Despite all the crap that's been said and written, a lot of it unfair and a lot of it ugly, we stayed the course and didn't pay attention to that and locked in on basketball," Blatt said. "Eat all that crow." Over the next several weeks, the Cavs started ripping off victories and piling up momentum as their new players and new scheme started taking hold. Love, James, and Irving combined for 63 points, and Mozgov had 16 points and 11 rebounds in a win over the Jazz. Smith nailed 7 three-pointers in a victory over the Hornets, in which Shumpert made his debut. The Cavs beat the Thunder as James had a duel with Kevin Durant, James scoring 34 points and Durant 32. At a game in Detroit, Irving put up 38 points and James had 32, as they continued to demonstrate their progress learning to find ways to succeed playing with each other. James missed a game with the Trailblazers because of a sprained wrist. Irving missed his first 7 shots, and it appeared the winning streak might be coming to an end that night. Then he had one of the most impressive shooting runs in NBA history, as he made 11 three-pointers and showed all his offensive mastery. His wizardry with the ball on dribbles, change of direction moves, and quick releases had the crowd delirious. He made 2 three-pointers in the final 75 seconds, 1 to tie and 1 to win with 6 seconds left over the much taller Nick Batum. He'd scored 55 points, a new career high, and one off James's franchise record, set in 2005. The 11 three-pointers were a franchise record. He even had 5 assists, leading the team. James sprinted to meet him after the game winner as Irving flexed at center court. As he drove home, James tweeted about what he'd just seen. "Just watched one of the greatest performances by a person, and he happens to be my teammate, running mate, brother, Kyrie Irving," he wrote. The Cavs ended up winning 12 in a row. Their defense was improving. The Shumpert and Smith additions had provided a huge lift on the perimeter, and Matthew Dellavedova, recovered from his own knee issue, was turning in quality performances. James and Irving were racking up numbers, and both were selected for the All-Star team in New York in February. This was closer to the situation that James had envisioned when he made the choice to return to Cleveland, his supporting cast executing their jobs. He had prepared himself for a breaking-in process, both with teammates and coaches, but it had been worse than he expected. He didn't realize how many bad habits there were. Not just actual performance within games, where he had to try to break them of what he saw as selfish streaks, but in how few of his teammates acted as professionals. In his mind, there wasn't enough extra work being put in after practice or in the film room. Not enough guys taking care of their bodies
in the waiter recovery rooms and, this might have bothered him the most, a lack of punctuality. Time was one of James's most valued possessions, and he hated it when people were late and made him wait. It also miffed him that some of his younger teammates were slobs, leaving the locker room a mess and letting the attendants clean it up. James hadn't counted on dealing with his own injury issues. He'd never missed more than 5 games with an ailment, his durability being one of his greatest traits. When the knee and back slowed him down, it slowed the assimilation process he'd been trying to force through. He'd also not predicted spending so much time and effort with leadership. Perhaps he was overstepping conventional bounds with Blatt, but he was doing it because he felt it had to be done. In truth, his plate had never been more full. He told people he felt like he'd already played 2 seasons because of how dramatic the transition had been. His statistics suffered, with his shooting numbers sagging backward. James had been proud, at times obsessed, with becoming a more efficient player as he matured. He loved that he'd improved his shooting percentage in 7 consecutive seasons. But this year, the challenges had knocked him off his routines. He loved routines, and the injuries had hurt his performance. He always said he didn't care about stats as long as he won, but that wasn't true. He did care about stats, dearly, just not more than wins. Now that the wins were coming and he was feeling healthier, he was easing off a little, but he didn't see a complete product. One area where James and the rest of the team hadn't made much progress was with Love. When the winning streak ended in Indianapolis, Love had just 5 points after getting only 8 shots. Even as the Cavs found some success after half a season in a morass, Love often wasn't much a part of it. Even as they ripped off victories, the loss to the Pacers was the 4th time in the previous 10 games that Love had failed to score 10 points. At times, he was a major part of the game plan. The night before the Indiana loss, he scored 24 points in a home win over the Clippers. But he was averaging 9 fewer points and 6 fewer shots per game than a year before. The Indiana loss was a low point for Love, who'd gotten frustrated with his role. Often, the game plan would be to feature him, and it would happen for the first 10 or so minutes. He racked up shots and stats in the 1st quarter, only to be forgotten by the 4th. He'd stand in the corner, waiting as James and Irving went to work. When he got yanked for his defensive shortcomings, he wasn't surprised. If they weren't going to involve him on offense, it wasn't worth having him out there. "I think it's one of the toughest situations I've had to deal with," Love said after the game in Indianapolis. "There's no blueprint for what I should be doing." Once again, the sentiment drummed up attention, because Love was a free agent to be. He'd repeatedly said his future was in Cleveland, but he wasn't thriving. The team took the next day off, but James, having read Love's quotes, sent a message. It was done again in an odd and indirect way, on social media. "Stop trying to find a way to fit out and just fit in. Be a part of something special. Just my thoughts." It appeared on James's Twitter account late in the evening. The phrase was strange, and it made its origin easier to identify. During the preseason, Love had used the same wording when explaining how he was trying to adapt to his new situation. "I'm comfortable and just not trying to, I guess, fit in so much," he said after a preseason game. "I had a talk with the guys, and they told me to fit out, just be myself." At the time, Love said he'd laughed at the concept because it didn't fit the classic team-first approach players are usually taught. "You always say check your egos at the door, but we also need to bring our egos with us because that's what makes us so great. We wouldn't be here without them," he said. But Love hadn't really followed this advice. He spent much of the season becoming a wallflower, drifting at the edges. His personality had been tough to read. When he made a mistake on the court, he frequently looked down and avoided eye contact with teammates or coaches. The same went for some interview sessions when he was uncomfortable with the questions. It was hard to get to know him, which made it hard to help him. Love had a cutting sense of humor and a broad set of interests. His background was fascinating. The son of an NBA player
and nephew of one of the founding members of the Beach Boys. He split his youth between the pristine suburbs of Portland, Oregon, and the basketball courts of Los